The following program is rated U for universal audiences and is considered suitable for listeners of all ages.
This is a presentation from Dream Realm Enterprises, where dreams are our reality.
Dream Realm Enterprises presents Showcase Classics, an anthology of classic stories and radio theater revivals for your listening pleasure. And now for our featured presentation of Jane Eyre.
Today, miss, I have a fresh loaf of rye just finished baking this morning. Only a farthing a slice.
No, thank you. Might I rest in that chair a while?
Suit yourself.
Are there any dressmakers or plain workwomen in the village?
Two or three. Quite as many as there is employment for.
Do you know of any neighbourhood where a servant is wanted?
I couldn't say for sure. Good morning. Fancy buying a slice of rye?
Will you give me a roll for this handkerchief?
No. I don't sell stuff that way.
Please, half a piece of stale cake.
No. But besides, how do I know where you got that handkerchief?
My gloves, then.
No. What could I do with them? Be off with you. Be off with you now.
Excuse me. What is the chief trade in this place? What do most people do here?
Farm labourers. A good deal of them work for Mr. Oliver's needle factory and at the foundry.
Does this Mr. Oliver employ women?
Nay, it's men's work.
What do the women do?
Some do one thing, some do another. Poor folk get on the best they can. Child, where are you going?
To feed the pigs, Father.
Will you give me that?
Father!
What's all the fuss?
This woman wants me to give her the pig's porridge.
Give it to her if she's a beggar. Pigs don't want it.
What do you want?
Is a servant wanted here?
No, we do not keep a servant here.
Can you tell me where I can get employment of any kind? I'm a stranger, without acquaintance, in this place. I want some work. No matter what.
I'm sorry, but I can give you no information.
Is this the parsonage?
Yes.
Is the clergyman in?
No.
Will he be in soon?
No, he's gone from home.
Is he a great distance away?
Not so far. 3 miles or so. He's been called away by the sudden death of his father. I expect he'll stay in Marsh End for at least another fortnight.
Is there any lady in this house?
None except myself. I'm the housekeeper. Now I've answered your questions, I suggest you leave.
Is there a country where they speak that way?
Yes, Hannah. A far larger country than England, where they talk in no other way.
And if either of you went there, you could understand what they say, I guess? We could probably tell something of what they said, but not all, for we are not as clever as you think us, Hannah. We don't speak German, and we can't read it without a dictionary to help us.
And what good does it do you?
We need to teach it sometimes. Or at least the elements, as they say. And then we shall get more money than we do now.
Very like. But give over your studying. You've done enough for tonight.
Oh, I think we have. At least I'm tired. Mary, are you?
Mortally. After all, tough work chipping away at a language with no master but a lexicon.
It is. Especially with such a language as this crabbed but glorious Deutsch. I wonder when St. John will come home.
Surely he will not be long now. It is just 10. It rains fast, Hannah. Do you have the goodness to look at the fire in the parlour?
Yes, Miss Mary. It's so lonesome now with your father's chair empty and sitting back into a corner. But we needn't wish him here. He's in a better place now.
You say he never mentioned us.
Don't think of it now, Miss Diana. You'll want your supper soon, and so will Master Simpson when he comes in.
What do you want?
May I speak to your mistresses?
You better tell me what you have to say to them. Where do you come from?
I am a stranger.
What is your business here at this hour?
I want a night's shelter in an outhouse. Anywhere. And a morsel of bread to eat.
I'll give you a piece of bread, but we can't take in a vagrant to lodge. It isn't likely.
Do let me speak to your mistresses.
No, not I. What can they do for you? You should not be roving about now. It looks very ill outside.
But where shall I go if you drive me away? What shall I do?
Oh, I'll warrant you know where to go and what to do. Mind you don't do wrong, that's all. Here's a penny. Now go.
A penny cannot feed me, and I have no strength to go farther. Don't shut the door up. Don't, for God's sake!
I must. The rain is driving in.
Tell the young ladies. Let me see them.
Indeed I will not. You are not what you ought to be, or you wouldn't make such a noise. Move off.
But I must die if I'm turned away.
Not you. I'm afraid you have an ill plan that brings you about folks' houses at this time of night. If you've any followers, housebreakers or such like anywhere near, you may tell them we are not by ourselves in the house. We have a gentleman, and dogs, and guns.
I can but die. I believe in God. Let me try to wait for his will. It's time.
All men must die. But all are not condemned to meet a lingering and premature doom, such as yours would be if you perished here of want.
Oh, what speaks?
Is it you, Master St. John?
Yes, yes, open quickly.
Well, how wet and cold you must be, such a wild night as it is. Come in, your sisters are quite uneasy about you, and I believe there are bad folks about. There's been a beggar woman. I declare, she's not gone yet. Laid down there. Get up! For shame! Move off, I say.
Hush, Hannah. I have a word to say to the woman. You have done your duty in excluding. Now let me do mine in admitting her. I was near and listened to both you and her. I think this is a peculiar case. I must at least examine into it. Young woman, rise. And pass before me into the house.
St. John, who is it?
I cannot tell. I found her at the door.
She does look white.
As white as clay or death. She will fall. Let her sit. Perhaps a little water would restore her. Hannah, fetch some. But she is worn to nothing. How very thin and how very bloodless.
A mere spectre.
Is she ill or just famished?
Famished, I think. Hannah, is that milk? Give it to me, and a piece of bread.
Try to eat.
Yes, try.
Not too much at first. Restrain her. She has had enough.
A little more, St. John. Look at the avidity in her eyes.
No more at present, sister. Try if she can speak now. Ask her her name.
My name is Jane Elliot.
And where do you live? Where are your friends? Can we send for anyone you know?
No.
What account can you give yourself?
Sir, I can give no details tonight.
But what do you expect me to do for you?
Nothing.
Do you mean that we have now given you what aid you require, and that we may dismiss you to the moor and the rainy night?
I will trust you. If I were a masterless and stray dog, I know that you would not turn me from your hearth tonight. As it is, I really have no fear. Do with me and for me as you like. But excuse me for much discourse. My breath is short. I feel a spasm when I speak.
Hannah, let her sit there at present, and ask her no questions. In 10 minutes more, give her the remainder of that milk and bread. Mary and Diana, let us go into the parlour and talk the matter over.
It is very well we took her in.
Yes, she would certainly have been found dead at the door in the morning had she been left out all night. I wonder what she has gone through.
Strange hardships, I imagine. Poor emaciated, pallid wanderer.
She is not an uneducated person, I should think. By her manner of speaking, her accent was quite pure, and the clothes she took off, though splashed and wet, were a little worn and fine.
She has a peculiar face. Fleshless and haggard as it is, I rather like it. And when in good health and animated, I can fancy her physiognomy would be agreeable.
Rather an unusual physiognomy. Certainly not indicative of vulgarity or degradation.
Far otherwise, to speak truth, St. John. My heart rather warms to the poor little soul. I wish we may be able to benefit her permanently.
That is hardly likely. You will find she is some young lady who has had a misunderstanding with her friends, and has probably injudiciously left them. We may perhaps succeed in restoring her to them, if she is not obstinate. But I trace lines of force in her face, which makes me skeptical of her tractability. She looked sensible, but not all that handsome.
She is so ill, St. John.
Ill or well, she would always be plain. The grace and harmony of beauty are quite wanting in those features.
What? You have got up? You are better, then. You may sit you down in my chair, if you will. Did you ever go begging before you came here?
You are mistaking me in supposing me a beggar. I am no beggar, any more than yourself or your young ladies.
I don't understand that. You've no house, no brass, I guess?
The want of house or brass, by which I suppose you mean money, does not make a beggar in your sense of the word.
Are you book-learned?
Yes, very.
But you've never been to a boarding school?
I was at a boarding school for 8 years.
Why can't you keep for yourself, then?
I have kept myself, and, I trust, shall keep myself again.
You've never been used to servants' work. I can see by your hands.
No, you are wrong. But tell me the name of the house where we are.
Some calls it Marsh End, and some calls it Moor House.
And the gentleman who lives here?
Nay, he doesn't live here. He's only staying a while. When he is at home, he's in his own parish at Morton.
That village, a few miles off?
Aye.
And what is he?
He is a parson.
This, then, was his father's residence?
Aye. I was quite mistaken in my thoughts of you. But there are so many cheats about. You must forgive me. Please don't think too harshly of me.
But I do think harshly of you, and I'll tell you why. Not so much because you refused to give me shelter, or regarded me as an impostor, as because you just now made it a species of reproach that I have no brass and no house. Some of the best people that ever lived have been as destitute as I am. And if you are a Christian, you ought not to consider poverty a crime.
Mr. St. John tells me so too, and I see I was wrong. But I've a different opinion of you now. You look like a downright decent creature.
That will do. I forgive you now.
Eat that now. You must be hungry. Hannah says you have had nothing but some gruel since breakfast.
You are very hungry.
I am, sir.
It is well for you that a low fever has forced you to abstain for the last 3 days. There would have been danger in yielding to the cravings of your appetite at first. Now you may eat, though still not immoderately.
I trust I shall not eat long at your expense, sir.
No. When you have indicated to us the residence of your friends, we can write to them, and you may be restored to home.
That, I must plainly tell you, is out of my power to do. Being absolutely without home, and without friends.
Do you mean to say that you are completely isolated from every connection?
I do. Not a tie links me to any living thing. Not a claim do I possess to admittance under any roof in England.
You have never been married. You're a spinster.
Why, she can't be above 17 or 18 years old, St. John.
I am near 19. But I am not married, no.
Where did you last reside?
The name of the place where, and of the person with whom, I lived, is my secret.
Which, if you like, you have, in my opinion, a right to keep, both from St. John and every other questioner.
Yet if I know nothing about you or your history, I cannot help you. And you need help, do you not?
I need it, and I seek it so far, sir, that some true philanthropist will put me in the way of getting work, which I can do, and the remuneration for which will keep me, if but in the barest necessities of life.
I know not whether I am a true philanthropist, yet I am willing to aid you to the utmost of my power in a purpose so honest. First, then, tell me what you have been accustomed to do and what you can do.
I am an orphan, the daughter of a clergyman. My parents died before I could know them. I was brought up a dependent, educated in a charitable institution. I will even tell you the name of the establishment where I passed 6 years as a pupil and 2 as a teacher. Lowood Orphan Asylum, Shire. You will have heard of it, Mr. Rivers? The Reverend Robert Brocklehurst is the treasurer.
I have heard of Mr. Brocklehurst, and I have seen the school.
I left Lowood nearly a year since, to become a private governess. I obtained a good situation and was happy. This place I was obliged to leave 4 days before I came here. The reason of my departure, I cannot and ought not to explain. It would be useless, dangerous, and would sound incredible. No blame attached to me. I am as free from culpability as any one of you three. Miserable I am, and must be for a time, for the catastrophe which drove me from a house I had found a paradise was of a strange and direful nature. I observed but 2 points in planning my departure. Speed. Secrecy. To secure these, I had to leave behind me everything I possessed except a small parcel, which, in my hurry and trouble of mind, I forgot to take out of the coach that brought me to Whitcross. To this neighbourhood, then, I came, quite destitute. I slept 2 nights in the open air, and wandered about 2 days without crossing a threshold. But twice in that space of time did I taste food, and it was when brought by hunger, exhaustion, and despair, almost to the last gasp, that you, Mr. Rivers, forbade me to perish of want at your door, took me under the shelter of your roof. I know all your sisters have done for me since, for I have not been insensible during my seeming torpor, and I owe to their spontaneous, genuine, genial compassion as large a debt as to your evangelical charity.
Don't make her talk, St. John. Miss Elliot.
Ah, yes.
You said your name was Miss Elliot?
I did say so. And it is the name by which I think it expedient to be called at present. But it is not my real name. And when I hear it, it sounds a bit strange to me.
Your real name you will not give?
I fear discovery above all things, and whatever disclosure would lead to it, I avoid.
You are quite right, I'm sure. Now do, brother, let her be at peace for a while.
You would not like to be long dependent on our hospitality. You would wish, I see, to dispense as soon as may be with my sister's compassion, and above all with my charity. I am quite sensible of the distinction drawn, nor do I resent it. It is just, you desire to be independent of us?
I do. I've already said so. Show me how to work or how to seek work. That is all I now ask. Then let me go. If it be but to the meanest cottage, but till then, allow me to stay here. I dread another essay of horrors, of homeless destitution.
My sisters, you see, have a pleasure in keeping you as they would have a pleasure in keeping and cherishing a half-frozen bird. Some wintry wind might have driven through their casement. I feel more inclination to put you in the way of keeping yourself, and shall endeavour to do so. But observe, my sphere is narrow. I am but the incumbent of a poor country parish. My aid must be of the humblest sort. And if you are inclined to despise the day of small things, seek some more efficient succour than such as I can offer.
She has already said that she is willing to do anything honest she can do, and you know, St. John, she has no choice of helpers. She's forced to put up with such crusty people as you.
I will be a dressmaker. I will be a plain workwoman. I will be a servant, a nurse girl, if no better.
Right. If such is your spirit, I promise to aid you in my own time and way. You have a question to ask of me?
Yes. I wish to know whether you have heard of any service I can offer myself to undertake.
I found or devised something for you 3 weeks ago, but as you seemed both useful and happy here, as my sisters had evidently become attached to you, and your society gave them unusual pleasure, I deemed it inexpedient to break in on your mutual comfort till their approaching departure from Marsh End should render yours necessary.
And they will go in 3 days now.
Yes, and when they go, I shall return to the parsonage at Morton. Hannah will accompany me, and this old house will be shut up.
What is the employment you had in view, Mr. Rivers? I hope this delay will not have increased the difficulty of securing it.
Oh, no. Since it is an employment which only depends on me to give, and you to accept, you need be in no hurry to hear. Let me frankly tell you I have nothing eligible or profitable to suggest. Before I explain, recall, if you please, my notice, clearly given, that if I helped you, it must be as the blind man would help the lame. I am poor, for I find that when I have paid my father's debts, all the patrimony remaining to me will be this crumbling grange, the row of scathed firs behind you, and the patch of moorish soil, with the yew trees and holly bushes in front. I am obscure. Rivers is an old name. But of the 3 sole descendants of the race, 2 earn the dependent's crust among strangers, and the 3rd considers himself an alien from his native country, not only for life, but in death. Yes, and deems, and is bound to deem himself honoured by the lot, and aspires but after the day when the cross of separation from fleshly ties shall be laid on his shoulders, and when the head of that church militant, of whose humblest members he is one, shall give the word, "Rise, follow me." And since I am myself poor and obscure, I can offer you but a service of poverty and obscurity. You may even think it degrading, for I see now your habits have been what the world calls refined. Your tastes lean to the ideal, and your society has at least been amongst the educated. But I consider that no service degrades which can better our race. I hold that the more arid and unreclaimed the soil where the Christian laborer's task of tillage is appointed him, the scantier the meed his toil brings, the higher the honor. His, under such circumstances, is the destiny of the pioneer. And the first pioneers of the gospel were the apostles. Their captain was Jesus, the Redeemer himself.
Well, proceed.
I believe you will accept the post I offer you and hold it for a while, Not permanently, though. Any more than I could permanently keep the narrow and narrowing, the tranquil hidden office of English country incumbent. For in your nature is an alloy as detrimental to repose as that in mine, though of a different kind.
Do explain.
I will, and you shall hear how poor the proposal is, how trivial, how cramping. I shall not stay long at Morton, now that my father is dead, and that I am my own master. I shall leave the place probably in the course of a twelvemonth. But while I do stay, I will exert myself to the utmost for its improvement. Morton, when I came to it 2 years ago, had no school. Children of the poor were excluded from every hope of progress. I established one for boys. I mean now to open a second school for girls. I have hired a building for the purpose, with a cottage of 2 rooms attached to it for the mistress's house. Her salary will be £30 a year. Her house is already furnished, very simply but sufficiently, by the kindness of a lady, Miss Oliver, the only daughter of the sole rich man in my parish, Mr. Oliver, the proprietor of a needle factory and iron foundry in the valley. The same lady pays for the education and clothing of an orphan from the workhouse, on condition that she shall aid the mistress in such menial offices connected with her own house and the school, as her occupation of teaching will prevent her having time to discharge in person. Will you be this mistress?
I thank you for the proposal, Mr. Rivers, and I accept it with all my heart.
Have you found your first day's work harder than you expected?
Oh, no. On the contrary. I think in time I shall get on with my scholars very well.
But perhaps your accommodations, your cottage, your furniture have disappointed your expectations? They are, in truth, scanty enough.
My cottage is clean and weatherproof, my furniture sufficient and commodious. All I see has made me thankful, not despondent. I am not absolutely such a fool and sensualist as to regret the absence of a carpet, a sofa, a silver plate. Besides, 5 weeks ago, I had nothing. I was an outcast, a beggar, a vagrant. Now I have acquaintance, a home, a business. I wonder at the goodness of God, the generosity of my friends, the bounty of my lot. I do not repine.
But you feel solitude and oppression. The little house there behind you is dark and empty.
I have hardly had time to enjoy the sense of tranquillity, much less grow impatient under one of loneliness.
Very well. I hope you feel the content you express. At any rate, your good sense will tell you that it is too soon yet to yield to the vacillating fears of Lot's wife. What you had left before I saw you, of course I do not know. But I counsel you to resist firmly every temptation which would incline you to look back. Pursue your present career steadily, for some months at least.
It is what I mean to do.
It is hard work to control the workings of inclination and turn the bent of nature, but that it may be done I know from experience. God has given us, in measure, the power to make our own fate. And when our energies seem to demand a sustenance they cannot get, when our will strains after a path we may not follow, we need neither starve from inanition, or stand still in despair. We have but to seek another nourishment, for the mind, as strong as the forbidden food it longed to taste, and perhaps purer, and to hew out for the adventurous foot a road as direct and broad as the one fortune has blocked up against us, if rougher than it. A year ago I was myself intensely miserable, because I thought I had made a mistake in entering the ministry. Its uniform duties wearied me to death. I burnt for the more active life of the world, for the more exciting toils of a literary career, for the destiny of an artist, author, orator, anything rather than that of a priest. Yes, the heart of a politician, of a soldier, of a votary of glory, a lover of renown, a lustre after power, beat under my curate surplice. I considered, My life was so wretched, it must be changed, or I must die. After a season of darkness and struggling, light broke and relief fell. My cramped existence all at once spread out to a plane without bounds. My powers heard a call from heaven to rise, gather their full strength, spread their wings and mount beyond ken. God had an errand for me, to bear which afar, to deliver it well, skill and strength, courage and eloquence. The best qualifications of soldier, statesman, and orator were all needed, for these all center in the good missionary. A missionary, I resolved to be. From that moment my state of mind changed. The fetters dissolved and dropped from every faculty, leaving nothing of bondage but its galling soreness, which time only can heal. My father indeed imposed the determination, but since his death I have not a legitimate obstacle to contend with. Some affairs settled, a successor for Morton provided, an entanglement or two of the feelings broken through or cut asunder, a last conflict with human weakness, in which I know I shall overcome, because I have vowed that I will overcome. And I leave Europe for the East.
Good evening, Mr. Rivers.
A lovely evening. But late for you to be out alone.
This afternoon, Papa told me you had opened your school and that the new mistress was come. And so I put on my bonnet after tea and ran up the valley to see her. This is she?
It is.
Do you think you shall like Morton?
I hope I shall. I have many inducements to do so.
Did you find your scholars as attentive as you expected?
Quite.
Do you like your house?
Very much.
Have I furnished it nicely?
Very nicely indeed.
I shall come up and help you teach sometimes. It'll be a change for me to visit you now and then, and I like a change. Mr. Rivers, last night, or rather this morning, I was dancing till 2 o'clock. The regiment are stationed there since the riots, and the officers are the most agreeable men in the world. They put all our young knife grinders and scissor merchants to shame. Papa says you never come to see us now. You are quite a stranger at Vale Hall. He is alone this evening and not very well. Will you return with me and visit him?
It is not a seasonable hour to intrude on Mr. Oliver.
Not a seasonable hour? But I declare it is. It is just the hour when Papa most wants company, when the works are closed and he has no business to occupy him. Now, Mr. Rivers, do come. Why are you so very shy and so very somber? I forgot. I am so giddy and thoughtless. Do excuse me. It had slipped my memory that you have good reason to be indisposed for joining in my chatter. Diana and Mary have left you to go work as governesses, and Morehouse is shut up, and you are so lonely. I am sure I pity you. Do come and see Papa.
Not tonight, Miss Rosamond. Not tonight.
Well, if you are so obstinate, I will leave you, for I dare not stay any longer. The dew begins to fall. Good evening.
Good evening.
She likes you, I'm sure. And her father respects you. Moreover, she's a sweet girl, rather thoughtless, but you would have sufficient thought for both yourself and her.
Does she like me?
Certainly, better than she likes anyone else.
Don't imagine such hard things. Fancy me yielding and melting as I am doing. Human love rising like a freshly opened fountain in my mind and overflowing with sweet inundation all the field I have so carefully and with such labor prepared, so assiduously sown with the seeds of good intentions, of self-denying plans, and now it is deluged with a nectarous flood, the young germ swamped, delicious poison cankering them. Now I see myself stretched on an ottoman in the drawing-room at Vale Hall, at my bride Rosamond Oliver's feet. She is talking to me with her sweet voice, gazing down on me with those eyes your skillful hand has copied so well, smiling at me with these coral lips. She is mine. I am hers. This present life and passing world suffice to me. Hush, say nothing. My heart is full of delight. My senses are entranced. It is strange that, while I love Rosamond Oliver so wildly, with all the intensity indeed of a first passion, the object of which is exquisitely beautiful, graceful, fascinating, I experience at the same time a calm, unwarped consciousness that she would not make me a good wife, that she is not the partner suited to me, that I should discover this within a year after marriage, and that to 12 months' rapture would succeed a lifetime of regret. This I know.
Strange indeed.
Well, something in me is acutely sensible to her charms, Something else is as deeply impressed with her defects. They are such that she could sympathize in nothing I aspired to be, to cooperate in nothing I undertook. Rosamond a sufferer, a laborer, a female apostle. Rosamond a missionary's wife. No.
But you need not be a missionary. You might relinquish that scheme.
Relinquish? What? My vocation, my great work, my foundation laid on earth for a mansion in heaven. My hopes have been numbered in the band who have merged all ambitions in the glorious one of bettering their race, of carrying knowledge into the realms of ignorance, of substituting peace for war, freedom for bondage, religion for superstition, the hope of heaven for the fear of hell. Must I relinquish that? It is dearer than the blood in my veins. It is what I have to look forward to, and to live for.
And Miss Oliver? Are her disappointment and sorrow of no interest to you?
Miss Oliver is ever surrounded by suitors and flatterers. In less than a month, my image will be effaced from her heart. She will forget me, and will marry, probably, someone who will make her far happier than I should do.
You trembled and became flushed when Miss Oliver entered the schoolroom.
You are original and not timid. There is something brave in your spirit, as well as penetrating in your eye. But allow me to assure you that you partially misinterpret my emotions. You think them more profound and potent than they are. You give me a larger allowance of sympathy than I have a just claim to. When I colour and when I shade before Miss Oliver, I do not pity myself. I scorn the weakness. I know it is ignoble, a mere fever of the flesh. Not, I declare, the convulsion of the soul. That is just as fixed as a rock, firm set in the depths of a restless sea. Know me to be what I am, a cold, hard man. You have taken my confidence by storm, and now it is much at your service. I am simply, in my original state, stripped of that blood-bleached robe with which Christianity covers human deformity. A cold, hard, ambitious man. Natural affection only, of all the sentiments, has permanent power over me. Reason and not feeling is my guide. My ambition is unlimited, my desire to rise higher, to do more than others, insatiable. I honour endurance, perseverance, industry, talent, because these are the means by which men achieve great ends and mount to lofty eminence. I watch your career with interest, because I consider you a specimen of a diligent, orderly, energetic woman. Not because I deeply compassionate what you have gone through, or what you still suffer.
You would describe yourself as a mere pagan philosopher?
No. There is this difference between me and deistic philosophers. I believe, and I believe the gospel. You missed your epithet. I am not a pagan, but a Christian philosopher. A follower of the sect of Jesus. What is this?
What's the matter?
Nothing in the world. Good afternoon.
Mr. Rivers, any ill news? Has something happened?
No. How very easily alarmed you are. I shall sully the purity of your floor, but you must excuse me for once. I have had hard work to get here, I assure you. One drift took me up to the waist. Happily, the snow is quite soft yet.
But why are you come?
Rather an inhospitable question to put to a visitor. But since you ask it, I answer simply to have a little talk with you. I got tired of my mute books and empty rooms. Besides, since yesterday I have experienced the excitement of a person to whom a tale has been half told, and who is impatient to hear the sequel. Come nearer the fire. I spoke of my impatience to hear the sequel of a tale. On reflection, I find the matter will be better managed by my assuming the narrator's part and converting you into a listener. Before commencing, it is but fair to warn you that the story will sound somewhat hackneyed in your ears. But stale details often regain a degree of freshness when they pass through new lips. For the rest, whether trite or novel, it is short.
I will listen.
20 years ago, a pure curate, never mind his name at this moment, fell in love with a rich man's daughter. She fell in love with him and married him, against the advice of all her friends, who consequently disowned her immediately after the wedding. Before 2 years passed, the rash pair were both dead, and laid quietly side by side under one slab. I have seen their grave. It formed part of the pavement of a huge churchyard surrounding the grim, soot-lacked old cathedral of an overgrown manufacturing town in Shire. They left a daughter, which, at its very birth, Charity received in her lap. Cold as that of the snowdrift I almost stuck fast in tonight. Charity carried the friendless thing to the house of its rich maternal relations. It was reared by an aunt-in-law, called, I come to names now, Mrs. Reed of Gateshead. You startle. Did you hear a noise? I dare say it is only a rat scrambling along the rafters of the adjoining schoolroom. It was a barn before I had it repaired and altered, and barns are generally haunted by rats. To proceed, Mrs. Reed kept the orphan 10 years. Whether it was happy or not with her, I cannot say, never having been told. But at the end of that time, she transferred it to a place you know, being no other than Lowood School, where you so long resided yourself. It seems her career there was very honourable. From a pupil, she became a teacher, like yourself. Really, it strikes me there are parallel points in her history and yours. She left it to be a governess. There, again, your fates were analogous. She undertook the education of the ward of a certain Mr. Rochester.
Mr. Rivers.
I can guess your feelings, but restrain them for a while. I have nearly finished. Hear me to the end. Of Mr. Rochester's character, I know nothing. But the one fact that he professed to offer honourable marriage to this young girl, and that at the very altar she discovered he had a wife yet alive, though a lunatic. What his subsequent conduct and proposals were is a matter of pure conjecture. But when an event transpired which rendered inquiry after the governess necessary, it was discovered she was gone. No one could tell when, where, or how. She had left Thornfield Hall in the night. Every research after her course had been vain. The country had been scoured far and wide. No vestige of information could be gathered respecting her. Yet that she should be found is become a matter of serious urgency. Advertisements have been put in all the papers. I myself have received a letter from one Mr. Briggs, a solicitor, communicating the details I have just imparted. Is it not an odd tale?
Just tell me this, and since you know so much, you surely can tell me. What of Mr. Rochester? How and where is he? What is he doing? Is he well?
I am ignorant of all concerning Mr. Rochester. The letter never mentions him but to narrate the fraudulent and illegal attempt I have adverted to. You should rather ask the name of the governess, the nature of the event which requires her appearance.
Did no one go to Thornfield Hall then? Did no one see Mr. Rochester?
I suppose not.
But they wrote to him?
Of course.
And what did he say? Who has his letters?
Mr. Briggs intimates that the answer to his application was not from Mr. Rochester, but from a lady. It is signed Alice Fairfax. He must have been a bad man.
You don't know him. Don't pronounce an opinion upon him.
Very well. And indeed my head is otherwise occupied than with him. I have my tale to finish. Briggs wrote to me of a Jane Eyre. The advertisements demanded a Jane Eyre. I knew a Jane Elliot. I confess I had my suspicions, but it was only yesterday afternoon that they were at once resolved into certainty. You own the name and renounce the alias?
Yes, yes. But where is Mr. Briggs? He perhaps knows more of Mr. Rochester than you do.
Briggs is in London. I should doubt his knowing anything at all about Mr. Rochester. It is not in Mr. Rochester he is interested. Meantime, you forgot essential points in pursuing trifles. You do not inquire why Mr. Breed sought after you?
Well, what did he want?
Merely to tell you that your uncle, Mr. Eyre of Madeira, is dead, that he has left you all his property, and that you are now rich. Merely that, nothing more.
I? Rich?
Yes, you. Rich. Quite an heiress. You must prove your identity, of course, a step which will offer no difficulties. You can then enter on immediate possession. Your fortune is vested in English funds. Briggs has the will and the necessary documents. You unbend your forehead at last. I thought Medusa had looked at you, and that you were turning to stone. Perhaps now you will ask how much you are worth?
How much am I worth?
Oh, a trifle. Nothing, of course, to speak of. 20,000 pounds, I think they say, but what is that?
20,000 pounds?
Well, if you had committed a murder and I had told you your crime was discovered, you could scarcely look more aghast.
It is a large sum. Don't you think there's a mistake? Perhaps you have read the figures wrong. It may be 2,000.
No mistake at all. It is written in letters, not figures. 20,000. If it were not such a very wild night, I would send Hannah down to keep you company. You look too desperately miserable to be left alone. But Hannah, poor woman, could not stride the drift so well as I. Her legs are not quite so long. So I must leave you to your sorrows. Good night.
Stop 1 minute.
Well?
It puzzles me to know why Mr. Briggs wrote to you about me. Or how he knew you. Or could fancy that you, living in such an out-of-the-way place, had the power to aid in my discovery.
Oh, I am a clergyman, and the clergy are often appealed to about odd matters.
No, that does not satisfy me. It is a very strange piece of business. I must know more about it.
Another time?
No. Tonight. You certainly shall not go until you've told me all.
But I apprised you that I was a hard man, difficult to persuade.
I am a hard woman. Impossible to put off.
Well, then I yield, if not to your earnestness, to your perseverance. A stone is worn by continual dropping. Besides, you must know someday, as well now as later. Your name is Jane Eyre?
Of course. That was all settled before.
You are not, perhaps, aware that I am your namesake?
No, indeed. I remember now seeing the letter E. Comprised in your initials, written in books you have at different times lent me. But I never asked for what name it stood. But what then, surely...
My mother's name was Eyre. She had two brothers, one a clergyman, who married Miss Jane Reed of Gateshead. The other, John Eyre, Esquire, merchant, later Funchal Madeira. Mr. Briggs, being Mr. Eyre's solicitor, wrote to us last August to inform us of our uncle's death. And to say he had left his property to his brother, the clergyman's orphan daughter, overlooking us, in consequence of a quarrel never forgiven, between him and my father. He wrote again a few weeks since, to intimate that the heiress was lost, and asking if we knew anything of her. A name casually written on a slip of paper has enabled me to find her out. You know the rest.
My Uncle John was your Uncle John? You, Diana, and Mary are his sister's children, and I am his brother's child.
Undeniably.
You three, then, are my cousins. Half our blood on each side flows from the same source.
We are cousins, yes.
Oh, I am glad.
Did I not say you neglected essential points to pursue trifles? You were serious when I had told you you got a fortune. And now, for a matter of no moment, you are excited.
Write to Diana and Mary tomorrow. Tell them to come home directly. Diana said they would both consider themselves rich with 1,000 pounds. So with 5,000, they will do very well.
You think so now because you do not know what it is to possess, nor, consequently, to enjoy wealth. You cannot form a notion of the importance 20,000 pounds would give you, of the place it would enable you to take in society, of the prospects it would open to you. You cannot.
And you cannot at all imagine the craving I have for fraternal and sisterly love. I never had a home. I never had brothers or sisters. I must and will have them now. You are not reluctant to admit me and own me, are you?
I think I can. I know I have always loved my own sisters, and I know on what my affection for them is grounded. Respect for their worth and admiration of their talents. You too have principle and mind. Your tastes and habits resemble Diana's and Mary's. Your presence is always agreeable to me. In your conversation I have already for some time found a salutary solace. I feel I can easily and naturally make room in my heart for you, as my third and youngest sister.
Thank you. That contents me for tonight.
Jane, I go in 6 weeks. I have taken my berth in an East Indiaman, which sails on the 20th of June.
God will protect you, for you have undertaken his work.
Jane, come with me to India. Come as my helpmeet and fellow labourer. God and nature intended you for a missionary's wife. It is not personal, but mental endowments they have given you. You are formed for labour, not for love. A missionary's wife you must, shall be. You shall be mine. I claim you, not for my pleasure, but for my sovereign service.
I am not fit for it. I have no vocation. But my powers, where are they for this undertaking? I do not feel them. Nothing speaks or stirs in me while you talk. I am sensible of no light kindling, no life quickening, no voice counseling or cheering. Oh, I wish I could make you see how much my mind is at this moment, like a rayless dungeon, with one shrinking fear fettered in its depths. The fear of being persuaded by you to attempt what I cannot accomplish.
I have an answer for you. Hear it. I have watched you ever since we first met. I have made you my study for 10 months. I have proved you in that time by sundry tests. And what I have seen and elicited? In the village school I found you could perform well, punctually, uprightly, labour uncongenial to your habits and inclinations. I saw you could perform it with capacity and tact. You could win while you controlled. In the calm with which you learnt you had become suddenly rich, I read a mind clear of the vice of Demas. Luca had no undue power over you. In the resolute readiness with which you cut your wealth into 4 shares, keeping but 1 to yourself, and relinquishing the 3 others to the claim of abstract justice, I recognized a soul that reveled in the flame and excitement of sacrifice. In the tractability with which, at my wish, you forsook a study in which you were interested, and adopted another because it interested me. In the untiring assiduity with which you have since persevered in it, in the unflagging energy and unshaken temper with which you have met its difficulties, I acknowledge the complement of the qualities I seek. Jane, you are docile, diligent, disinterested, faithful, constant and courageous, very gentle and very heroic. Cease to mistrust yourself. I can trust you unreservedly, as a conductress of Indian schools and a helper amongst Indian women. Your assistance will be to me invaluable. I shall give you a quarter of an hour for your answer. What does your heart say?
I am ready to go to India, if I may go free.
Your answer requires a commentary. It is not clear.
I regard you as a brother. You, me as a sister. So let us continue.
We cannot! It would not do. I want a wife. The sole helpmeet I can influence efficiently in life, and retain absolutely till death.
Seek one elsewhere than in me. Seek one fitted to you.
One fitted to my purpose, you mean? Fitted to my vocation. Again, I tell you, it is not the insignificant private individual, the mere man with the man's selfish senses. I wish to mate. It is the missionary.
And I will give the missionary my energies. It is all he wants. But not myself. That would only be adding the husk and shell to the kernel. For them he has no use. I retain them.
You cannot. You ought not. Do you think God will be satisfied with half an oblation? Will he accept a mutilated sacrifice? It is the cause of God I advocate. It is under his standard I enlist you. I cannot accept on his behalf a divided allegiance. It must be entire.
Oh, I will give my heart to God. You do not want it.
It is what I want. And there are obstacles in the way. They must be hewn down. Jane, you would not repent marrying me. Be certain of that. We must be married. I repeat it, there is no other way. And undoubtedly enough of love would follow upon marriage to render the union right, even in your eyes.
I scorn your idea of love. I scorn the counterfeit sentiment you offer. Yes, I scorn you when you offer it.
I think I have done nothing to deserve scorn.
My dear cousin, abandon your scheme of marriage. Forget it.
I know where your heart turns, and to what it clings. The interest you cherish is lawless and unconsecrated. Long since you ought to have crushed it. Now you should blush to allude to it. You think of Mr. Rochester.
I must find out what has become of him.
If I listened to human pride, I should say no more to you of marriage with me. But I listen to my duty, and keep steadily in view my first aim, to do all things to the glory of God. My master was long-suffering, so will I be. I cannot give you up to perdition as a vessel of wrath. Repent, resolve, while there is yet time. Remember, we are bid to work while it is day, warned that the night cometh when no man shall work. Remember the fate of Devas, who had his good things in this life. God give you strength to choose that better part which shall not be taken from you. Could you decide to marry me now?
I could decide if I were but certain. Were I but convinced that it was God's will I should marry you. I could vow to marry you here and now, come afterwards, what would?
My prayers are heard.
Show me the path.
Jane! Jane!
What is it?
What do you hear? What do you see?
Where are you? I'm coming! Wait for me!
Will you take my arm, sir? There is a heavy shower coming on. Had you not better go in?
Leave me alone.
Miss Eyre, is it really you, miss? Have you finally come back to this lonely place?
What happened here?
The fire broke out at dead of night, and before the engines arrived from Milcote, the building was one mass of flame. It was a terrible spectacle.
At dead of night? Was it known how it originated?
Miss Jane!
How are you, Leah?
Well enough, miss.
I was explaining to Miss Eyre about the fire.
His poor wife said it. The mad creature broke out of her attic room and set some drapes on fire.
What happened to her?
Mr. Rochester went to find her. She was in your room, Miss Eyre, raving and carrying on like the frantic lunatic she was.
He tried to stop her, but she fought him wildly and then she leapt from the window.
God have mercy.
I found her, miss, sprawled out on the pavement. There was no saving her.
And Mr. Rochester, is he...
Leah! Where the deuce is my tray?
Give the tray to me, Leah. I will take it to him.
He won't wish to see you, miss. He refuses everybody.
Why?
It was all his own courage. And a body may say his kindness, in a way, Miss Eyre. He wouldn't leave the house till everyone else was out before him. As he came down the great staircase at last, after Mrs. Rochester had flung herself from the battlements, there was a great crash all fell. He was taken out from under the ruins, alive, but sadly hurt. A beam had fallen in such a way as to protect him partly, but one eye was knocked out, and one hand so crushed that Mr. Carter, the surgeon, had to amputate it directly. The other eye inflamed. He lost the sight of that also. He is now helpless, indeed, blind and a cripple.
Give me the water, Leah. This is you, Leah, is it not?
Leah is in the kitchen.
Answer me. Speak again. Who is it? Who speaks?
Will you have a little more water, sir?
Great heaven. What great delusion has come over me? What sweet madness! Is it Jane? What is it? This is her shape. This is her size.
And this her voice. She's all here. Her heart, too. God bless you, sir. I'm glad to be so near you again.
Jane Eyre!
My dear master. I am Jane Eyre. I have found you out. I am come back to you.
My living darling. These are certainly her limbs. And these her features. But I cannot be so blessed after all my misery. It is a dream. Such dreams as I have had at night when I have clasped her once more to my heart as I do now. And kissed her as thus. And felt that she loved me. And trusted that she would not leave me.
Which I never will, sir. From this day.
Never will, says the vision. But I always woke and found it an empty mockery. And I was desolate and abandoned. My life dark, lonely, hopeless. My soul athirst and forbidden to drink. My heart famished and never to be fed. Gentle, soft dream, nestling in my arms now. You will fly too, as your sisters have all fled before you. But kiss me before you go. Embrace me, Jane.
There, sir. And there.
And you do not lie dead in some ditch under some stream? And you are not a pining outcast among strangers?
No, sir. I am an independent woman now.
Independent? What do you mean, Jane?
My uncle in Madeira is dead. And he left me £5,000.
But as you are rich, Jane, you have now no doubt friends who will look after you and not suffer you to devote yourself to a blind amateur like me.
I am my own mistress and will stay with you if you wish.
No, no. No, Jane. You must not go. No, I have touched you, heard you, felt the comfort of your presence, the sweetness of your consolation. I cannot give up these joys. I have little left in myself. I must have you. The world may laugh, may call me absurd, selfish, but it does not signify. My very soul demands you. It will be satisfied, or it will take deadly vengeance on its frame. Oh, Jane, what did I feel when I discovered you had fled from Thornfield, and when I could nowhere find you, and after examining your apartment, ascertained that you had taken no money, nor anything which could serve as equivalent. A pearl necklace I had given you lay untouched in its little casket. Your trunks were left corded and locked as they had been prepared for the bridal tour. What could my darling do, I asked, left destitute and penniless? And what did she do? Let me hear now. Ah, here I reach the root of the matter. He wanted you to marry him.
He asked me to marry him.
Oh, that is a fiction. An impudent invention to vex me.
I beg your pardon. It is the literal truth. He asked me more than once, and was as stiff about urging his point as ever you could be.
Miss Eyre, I repeat it. You can leave me. How often am I to say the same thing? Why do you remain pertinaciously perched on my knee when I have given you notice to quit?
Because I'm comfortable there.
No, Jane, you are not comfortable there. Because your heart is not with me. It is with this cousin, this St. John. Oh, till this moment I thought my little Jane was all mine. I had a belief she loved me, even when she left me. That was an atom of sweet in much bitter. Long as we have been parted, hot tears have I wept over our separation. I never thought that, while I was mourning her, she was loving another. But it is useless grieving. Jane, leave me. Go and marry Rivers.
Shake me off, then, sir.
Push me away, for I'll not leave you of my own accord.
Jane, I ever like your tone of voice. It still renews hope, it sounds so truthful. When I hear it, it carries me back a year. I forget that you have formed a new tie. But I am not a fool. Go!
Where must I go, sir?
Your own way, with the husband you have chosen.
And who is that?
You know, this St. John Rivers.
He is not my husband, nor ever will be. He does not love me. I do not love him. He loves, as he can love, and that is not as you love, a beautiful young lady called Rosamond. He wanted to marry me only because he thought I should make a suitable missionary's wife, which she would not have done. He is good and great, but severe, and for me cold as an iceberg. He's not like you, sir. I am not happy at his side, nor near him, nor with him. He has no indulgence for me, no fondness. He sees nothing attractive in me, not even youth, only a few useful mental points. Ah, then, I must leave you, sir, to go to him.
What, Jane? Is this true? Is such really the state of matters between you and Rivers?
Absolutely, sir. Oh, you need not be jealous. I wanted to tease you a little to make you less sad. I thought anger would be better than grief. But if you wish me to love you, could you but see how much I do love you, you would be proud and content. All my heart is yours, sir. It belongs to you. And with you it would remain, were fate to exile the rest of me from your presence forever.
Jane, I want a wife.
Do you, sir?
Yes. Is it news to you?
Of course, you said nothing about it before.
Is it unwelcome news?
That depends on the circumstances, sir. On your choice.
Which you shall make for me, Jane. I will abide by your decision.
Choose then, sir. Her who loves you best.
I will at least choose her I love best. Jane, will you marry me?
Yes, sir.
A poor, blind man, whom you will have to lead about by the hand. A crippled man, 20 years older than you, whom you will have to wait on.
Yes, sir.
Truly, Jane.
Most truly, sir.
Oh, my darling. God bless you and reward you.
Mr. Rochester, if ever I did a good deed in my life, if ever I thought a good thought, if ever I prayed a sincere and blameless prayer, if ever I wished a righteous wish, I am rewarded now. To be your wife is, for me, to be as happy as I can be on this earth.
But a curious point. I was in my own room, and sitting by the window, which was open. It soothed me to feel the balmy night air, though I could see no stars, and only by a vague luminous haze knew the presence of a moon. I longed for thee, Jane. Oh, I longed for thee both with soul and flesh. I asked of God, at once in anguish and humility, if I had not been long enough desolate, afflicted, tormented, and might not soon taste bliss and peace once more. That I merited all I endured, I acknowledged. That I could scarcely endure more, I pleaded. And the Alpha and Omega of my heart's wishes broke involuntarily from my lips in the words, Jane! Jane! Jane!
Did you speak these words aloud?
I did, Jane. If any listener had heard me, he would have thought me mad. I pronounced them with such frantic energy.
And it was last Monday night? Somewhere near midnight?
Yes, but the time is of no consequence. What followed is the strange point. You will think me superstitious. Some superstition I have in my blood, and always had. Nevertheless, this is true. True at least it is that I heard what I now relate. As I exclaimed, Jane, 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 a voice. I cannot tell whence the voice came, but I know whose voice it was.
I am coming. Wait for me. Where are you?
Ah, Jane, perhaps your soul wandered from its cell to comfort mine. For those were your accents. As certain as I live, they were yours. I thank my Maker that in the midst of judgment, he has remembered mercy. I humbly entreat my Redeemer to give me strength to lead henceforth a purer life than I have done hitherto.
Listener, I married him. Edward continued blind for the first 2 years of marriage. And then slowly, the sight in one eye became restored to him. And when our first child was placed into his arms, he could see that the boy had inherited his eyes, as they once were. Large, brilliant, and black.
You've been listening to Part 5 and the conclusion of Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte and adapted as an audio play by Rachel Pulliam. Our cast in order of appearance include Bruce Busby as announcer, Carrie Michael Ayers as shopkeeper, Colette Feehan as Jane Eyre, Shane Harris as father, Gabe Harris as child, Abby Brown as woman, Lexi DeSoller as housekeeper, Margaret Ashley as Hannah, Mindy Rast Keenan as Mary Rivers, Alexa Chipman as Diana Rivers, Joshua Spector as St. John Rivers, Delaney Brittingham as Rosamond Oliver, Jarman Day as John, Peter Himesoth as Edward Rochester, and Alexandra Macedo as Leah. Jane Eyre was directed and produced for Dream Realm Enterprises Showcase Classics by Rachel Pulliam. All sound effects were provided by freesound.org, with original music composed by Ross Bernhardt. The Showcase Classics theme was composed by Tom Rory Parsons.
Coming soon to Soul Twin Audios.
I woke up on the floor shivering. All my clothes were gone. It was like a nightmare I had dreamed many times before and dreaded coming true.
Convened in the first court at 1800 hours in this day of our world, the 18th of November, 2462, you will be taken from your cell to the Division of Agriculture for processing.
No.
Your body will be reduced to its basic components.
Oh, no.
And your existence on Earth will be terminated.
In God's name, give me another chance.
It is the decision of this court.
You can't condemn a man to die for writing a few lines of poetry.
Not for writing a few lines of poetry, for being a poet.
This program is copyright 2022, all rights reserved, and is brought to you by Dream Realm Enterprises, always warping to new dimensions.